Welcome. This is Dr. Michio Kaku, Professor of Theoretical Physics at the City College and the Graduate Center of the City University of New York. And this is Exploration. Every week on Exploration, we discuss the fascinating world of science and its impact on society. And today, leading off, we're going to give you a one-month assessment of the tragedy still emerging from Japan. What about the earthquake, the tsunami, and of course, the nuclear accident, which has devastated large portions of northern Japan and terrified the world? And then, if we phase out nuclear power, then what about the greenhouse effect? Some people say that we need nuclear energy in order to save the planet from the greenhouse effect. But there are other people who say that, well, maybe a combination of solar power, wind power, renewable power, and also technical fixes may solve the greenhouse problem. So we're going to bring on our special guest today, Eli Klintisch, author of the book Hacking the Planet, Using Technical Fixes Perhaps to Solve the Greenhouse Effect. Well, let's just jump right into some of the top stories of the past week. It's been roughly a month since that horrible 9.0 earthquake and tsunami devastated northern Japan, destroying four reactors at the Fukushima site, causing enormous anxiety and world tension as people watched the radiation spread from this nuclear accident. Well, it's been about a month since that accident, so now we can begin a process of assessing what happened, what was the extent of the danger, how dangerous is this accident, and what about the future? First of all, don't believe the rather rosy assessment made by the utility. The utility has a long history of covering up previous nuclear accidents. Instead, the Nuclear Regulatory Commission of the United States assembled a team of internationally recognized scientists to prepare a report, the best case report, the assessment of what really happened on March 11, when that 9.0 earthquake released a tsunami which wiped out four nuclear power plants. First of all, it's becoming clear that there were design mistakes in the design of these nuclear power plants. There was a seawall placed around the Fukushima site, and people relied upon this 15-foot seawall that surely would deflect any tsunami coming from the ocean. Well, the best laid plans of mice and men. The tidal wave that actually hit the Fukushima site was roughly 45 feet tall, overwhelming the 15-foot seawall, but then it knocked out all the generators in the basement of the reactor. Now, personally, it's hard to imagine anything more silly than putting all your backup generators in the basement of your reactor, where surely they would all be knocked out simultaneously, leaving you without any backup system whatsoever. So think of a car accident that proceeds in three parts. The first part is that, well, your car spins out of control. So what do? You hit the brakes. That's the emergency system. But the brakes don't work. And that's because the tidal wave knocked out all the backup generators in the basement of the reactor site. That set off a cascade, which then takes us into Act 2. Act 2 is your car is now spinning out of control, brakes don't work, and the car begins to overheat. At that point, you begin to realize that, oh my God, the radiator is overheating and it's going to blow. And sure enough, the radiator explodes. In fact, we had four hydrogen gas explosions at the Fukushima site. What happens is when you heat uranium rods, the zirconium cladding surrounding the uranium rods begin to interact with the water, releasing hydrogen gas. Hydrogen gas is quite volatile, will combine with oxygen, and then any spark could set off a hydrogen gas explosion. Well, as you saw from the pictures, the roofs of these reactors were completely blown to pieces by the hydrogen gas explosion. So there you are in a car. The brakes don't work. The radiator begins to overheat and then explodes. And then worse, you begin to realize that the gasoline in your gas tank is also overheating and is about to catch on fire, which would then incinerate you and all your passengers. Well, what do you do then? What do you do then is, As a last-ditch effort, you run the car into a river. That's equivalent to shooting seawater from the Pacific Ocean directly into the cores of three nuclear power plants. Well, actually, that saved the day. It turns out that the meltdown was in progress. The cores were uncovered. Temperatures were rising to 5,000 degrees Fahrenheit, the melting point of uranium dioxide. And just in the nick of time, as we were about to see a tragedy beyond comprehension unfold in northern Japan, seawater is flooding into these three reactors, stopping the meltdown. Well, then, of course, there are repercussions to sending in seawater. And that is, seawater causes salt. Salt deposits will choke up the cooling system. And so then you begin to realize that after you shoot your car into the river simply is not tall enough to cool down your car. So what do? You get on the cell phone and call the local fire department. That's right. It turns out that firemen are now responsible for cooling down these nuclear power plants and preventing a full-scale meltdown. So that's the end of Act 2. Remember, in Act 1, your brakes didn't work. In Act 2, your radiator blows up, your gas tank is about to explode, you run it into a river, the river is not enough to cool the reactor, that is your engine, and you have to call in the local fire department. Well, now we're entering stage 3. In Act 3, we're now going to have independent assessment of what really happened, because utility, at every step of the way, has been giving us reassuring statements that things are stable. Well, yeah, they're stable in the same way that you're barely hanging in on a cliff with your fingernails, and your fingernails are breaking one by one. Yeah, it's stable in the sense of you have a ticking time bomb, and it's only a matter of time before something tips it over. Well, the Nuclear Regulatory Commission of the United States assembled an independent panel of nuclear engineers and physicists to analyze what really happened. Forget the propaganda coming out from the utility. First of all, their assessment was much darker, much more serious than the rosy statements coming out from the utility. They broke it down one by one. Unit 1, the core was exposed. Who knows precisely how much, but core damage. Core damage to 100 tons of uranium dioxide is about 70%. 70% core damage in Unit 1. And salt left over from salt water is now beginning to block the cooling process. And it means that Unit 1 could eventually heat up again because melted fuel and salt is blocking the flow of cold water. Unit 2, it suffered 33% core damage. However, some of the fuel actually melted down to the bottom of the vessel, the reactor vessel, which is about 6 inches of carbon steel, and actually melted right through the 6 inches of carbon steel, and then plunged onto the very bottom of the containment structure. So Unit 2 apparently sustained the most damage. We have what is called a breach of containment. That is a melting right through the reactor vessel holding the uranium dioxide, something that is simply not supposed to happen, happened in Unit 2. Unit 3, the damage is not clear, because radioactive levels are so high and radiation gauges were damaged that it's really impossible to get a good assessment of the damage in Unit 3. Unit 4 has a spent fuel pond that apparently was exposed to the air. It was supposed to be covered with water all the time, but water levels dropped, radiation levels soared, temperatures rose, and an explosion blew parts of the fuel rods 1 mile from the site. Think of it. It's like launching a rocket. The spent fuel pond at Unit 4 blew up with a hydrogen gas explosion with such a force that parts of the fuel rod blew 1 mile from the site. Then pieces began to land on the ground, which were highly radioactive. These are spent fuel rods, high-level nuclear waste. Workers using radiation monitors detected it and said, oh my gosh. So they had to get bulldozers to cover up the high radiation from that site. Now, to make matters worse, because they use hose water and seawater to keep the reactor cool, And because there's no circulation of the pumps, it means they're simply accumulating more and more water. Hundreds of tons of water are accumulating on the site. And what are they going to do with it? Some of it they dump right into the Pacific Ocean. Well, that caused an uproar because radiation levels soared to over a million times legal level right next to the reactor site in the ocean. Well, they were able to repair a leak, but again, they don't know the full scale of melting in Unit 2. Where is the radiation coming from? Well, quite frankly, they don't know. The best assessment is that the core of Unit 2 has melted right through. The vessel structure is in direct contact with cooling water, and that cooling water circulates and eventually gets dumped into the Pacific. Well, because of that bad publicity, the engineers quickly were able to seal up that leak, but that still does not mean they control the melting of Unit 2 itself. That's perhaps the most concern right now with this reactor accident. So the reactor operators are in a catch-22 situation. First, they have to have firemen go in with hose water, the old-fashioned way, and with seawater to keep the core covered so that radiation levels and temperatures don't rise to incredible levels. But that means that the water leaks right through. There's a leak someplace, and the leak is in contact with molten fuel, which means that radiation is continuing to pour right into this water, which has to be contained on site. So the more water they use to contain the system, the more wastewater they create. So it's a catch-22 situation. They're damned if they do, and they're damned if they don't. Well, now let's give you a best case and a worst case scenario. The best case scenario is, sometime perhaps later this year, they finally get the pumps working again. Then these poor firemen can take a rest, and automatic pumps can circulate the water through the site. At that point, it would reach stability. At that point, that's when you reach the bottom of this accident. So believe it or not, we haven't reached bottom yet. So sometime later this year, in the most optimistic scenario, the pumps get working again. Well, why don't they turn on the pumps now? The problem is that the water is so radioactive, especially in the turbine rooms, that workers can only go in a few minutes at a time. They would receive a full year's dose of radiation in just a few minutes. In other words, the radiation levels in the turbine room are lethal. You could die sitting in that turbine room absorbing all that radiation, and that's why they can't get the pumps working. So the best case scenario is they get the pumps working sometime later this year, and then becomes the tedious process of cleaning up the mess. And then perhaps a few years from now, the very delicate operation of opening up the cores, sending in cameras to actually photograph the full extent of melting, the full extent of where the uranium went in order to stop the leakage of radiation into the environment. And then they begin to dismantle the reactor. And after that, in about a 10-year operation, they entomb. They entomb the reactor, just like at Chernobyl, in a concrete tomb of sand, boric acid, and cement. That's the best case scenario, taking place over a period of 10 years. The worst case scenario is another earthquake, another pipe break, means that radiation levels begin to soar. Evacuation is mandatory. Radioactive levels are too high. Workers leave the site. There's no more firemen putting hose water on top of the cores. As a consequence, temperatures begin to rise once again. Water boils off. Another hydrogen gas explosion. Steam explosion as cold water touches hot metal. And the steam explosion then begins to rupture the already weakened containment structure. At that point, you have raw uranium being exposed to the outside environment. Clouds of uranium dioxide begin to rise from the site, just like at Chernobyl. The only difference is, instead of one reactor, we have three nuclear reactors in a full-scale meltdown scenario. And then as the winds carry the radiation, we're talking about a catastrophe beyond human comprehension. Huge parts of northern Japan could be reduced to a dead zone, perhaps for hundreds of years. Cesium-137 has a half-life of 30 years. meaning that it's radioactive for about 300 years, and huge parts of Japan may be simply off-limits for centuries.
Now I'd like to introduce our special guest for today. You know, it was Mark Twain who once said, "Everyone complains about the weather, but no one ever does anything about it." Well, that was a joke 150 years ago, of course, because what can you do about the weather after all? And if the weather is going to go berserk in the future with global warming, then the question is, are there technical fixes? Geoengineering is a word that sounds like a contradiction in terms. The Earth is 8,000 miles in diameter. It's huge. It's humongous. And engineering requires that humans intervene with our machines. So how can our machines possibly change the entire Earth? The damage we've done by spewing out tremendous amounts of carbon dioxide has set off effects in the atmosphere that seem to be irreversible. But are they? Well, our special guest today is Eli Kentish. He's a reporter for Science Magazine. He's written for Slate, Discover, and the New Republic, and his new book is called Hack the Planet. Science's best hope or worst nightmare for averting climate catastrophe. So in this hour, we're going to talk about some of the most imaginative and some of the most harebrained crackpot schemes that scientists and engineers have devised to save the planet using an untested technology called geoengineering. The first question for you is, how did you first get interested in science as a youth?
Well, I think it was watching Mr. Wizard on television as a kid. I really enjoyed the experiments that Mr. Wizard did with his children that were guests on the show. And I guess just being raised in a household where I was encouraged by my father to, you know, play with chemical sets or to collect rocks or go out into the forest and go hiking. I guess just a general sense of exploration as a child made me interested in science.
And how did you first get interested in the idea of writing a book called Hack the Planet?
Well, for my in my day job, I work at Science Magazine, and I didn't know what the word geoengineering was until 2007, only 3 years ago, when I went to this really striking meeting at Harvard University, which I describe in the book. In that meeting, we all thought the sort of established top scientists in climate change would dissuade this kind of fringe group from studying geoengineering because it was considered almost uncouth to think about these wild schemes. But on the contrary, what happened at that meeting in 2007 was that some very distinguished senior scientists decided that the severity of the climate challenge requires us to think about these radical methods, and the geoengineering clique, as I describe them in my book, got the blessing instead of being shunned.
Okay. Now, in your book, you lay out four possible scenarios. And these are, well, worst-case scenarios. Some people think they'll never happen or they'll happen maybe in 100 years, but you take them seriously. So lay out these four scenarios and the implications and the likelihood.
Well, the worst-case scenarios I describe are each probably unlikely, but one of the challenges is we don't know their likelihood. It's only in the last decade or so that climate scientists have started to think about these so-called tipping points. One of them, which gets probably the most attention, is large-scale melting of the poles. And we've seen that sea ice is disappearing faster than scientists expected only 5 years ago. That's the ice that forms on the surface of the ocean. It's disappearing mostly in the Arctic, although it's okay in the Antarctic. But the ice sheets, which sit on Greenland and both sides of Antarctica, are disintegrating faster than models suggested only a few years ago. And the Arctic is the fastest warming place on Earth, as the dark ocean, as the white ice is replaced with dark ocean, and that ocean absorbs heat. And so scientists are really in the dark about how fast the poles could disintegrate, because the models they use to predict are really shown to be outdated, and the system is moving faster than they can respond to.
Now, the Arctic ice near the North Pole is gone by about 50% if you look at submarine data taken from the 1950s, and now about a 50% thinning. But what about the South Pole? Most of the water is in the South Pole.
Right. For a while, there was hope that the South Pole would be stable. But in recent years, they've found that, yes, the South Pole is losing mass in the same way that Greenland has. I mean, Greenland is further south and closer to the equator, so it gets more heat. But unfortunately, they're starting to find that Greenland is showing signs more sensitivity than they feared. Excuse me, Antarctica is showing more signs of sensitivity than they feared.
And isn't there also a runaway effect? As you mentioned, the less ice there is, the less sunlight is reflected back into outer space, which causes more global warming, which causes less ice. Isn't there a runaway effect?
That's why they considered the disintegration of the poles a so-called tipping point or feedback, because the fear is that at some point in the future, if the temperature passes some certain unknown threshold, that the feedback effect, as you describe it, would create a runaway warming. You'd have melting ice, more black water, more melting ice, more black water. It's also, despite the crazy schemes in my book, it's unclear that there's actually a way to reverse the disintegration of the ice sheets on a large scale.
And
there's too much inertia in the system.
And doesn't this also mean that at a certain point, some of the great cities of the Earth could be underwater by maybe mid-century or perhaps late in the century?
It's unclear how fast the ice sheets would disintegrate. The ice on the surface of the ocean doesn't affect sea level because, like an ice cube in a glass, as it melts, the level of the water in the glass stays the same. But the ice that's sitting on land, the three ice sheets, would affect sea level rise. And right now, it's only a slight effect, although it's rising. But the fear is that it could accelerate in the future. And there are, of course, billions of people, and some of the most vulnerable people in the world, especially in Southeast Asia, who would be facing real crises from melting ice. I should also mention that it's not just the ice sheets that are vulnerable. We've already seen thousands and thousands of glaciers in the mountains disappear or disintegrate, and that could lead to ice, to real shortages in the future of water for people who need it.
Okay, and your second scenario is mega droughts. Could you elaborate?
One thing we know about previous changes in the Earth's climate in the past is that some of these changes have been associated with these mega droughts, and scientists now consider the Dust Bowl, which occurred obviously in the 1930s in the United States, as a climatic effect, and something which could happen in the future. Scientists just don't know what sort of effects it could have. But even if we didn't have the droughts, the shortage of water, just the rise of temperature could affect agriculture very substantially. Scientists know that with every degree Fahrenheit temperature rise, crops lose as much as 5 or 10% of their yield, including major grain crops like corn or rice. And so, it's really... The implications for agriculture in a warming world are really frightening, not only a world with drier conditions in certain places.
And the next scenario is methane release. Could you elaborate?
There's many, many billion. We emit about 8 billion tons of carbon a year in man-made activities, but there's much, much more carbon locked up in various forms in the permafrost as well as in the deep ocean. And that's carbon mostly held as methane, which is a greenhouse gas much more potent than carbon dioxide. And so the fear is that as the temperature of the Earth rises, that frozen carbon would be released, creating yet another sort of runaway effect, as you describe it.
Yeah, and so more methane, more global warming, more tundra being melted, thawing out all this vegetation that was frozen thousands of years ago. And then you talk about what could happen to the ocean currents. Could you elaborate?
Right. The reason Europe sits some 10 degrees, you know, major cities in Europe like London sit some 10 degrees latitude further north than, Boston or New York. And the reason, though, they've got a fairly temperate climate is because warm water from the equator is brought by the global conveyor, which moves around the world's ocean. And there's evidence in the past that this conveyor, which delivers warm water to Europe as well as drives countless climate systems around the world, there's evidence that in the past this conveyor has been shut down. Specifically, as the balance of salty and fresh water has changed. And so there's fear that as the fresh water locked up in the ice sheets is delivered into the ocean, it might shut down the conveyor. And the last time this happened, I believe it was some tens of thousands of years ago, there was total chaos on Earth, and I describe it in my book.
So we're talking about a mini ice age that's set off, ironically, by global warming, right?
Right. The movie The Day After Tomorrow, which came out four or five years ago, described this. It showed ice covering North America and Europe, just a mini ice age related not to the global temperature per se, but simply to the distribution of heat around the planet, because this conveyor, this global ocean conveyor, allows areas, northern and southern areas, to get warm from the center of the planet.
Well, that concludes the first part of our interview with Eli Kintish, author of the book Hacking the Planet. If you want to learn more about the future of energy, the future of the world, in fact, get a copy of my latest book. It's called Physics of the Future, about the next 100 years. How will jobs, biotechnology, medicine, computers, robotics affect our life? Get a copy because it's now a New York Times bestseller. So once again, my latest book is called Physics of the Future, about the next 100 years in science and technology. The book, Physics of the Future, is now number 6 on the New York Times bestseller list. Number 6 on the New York Times bestseller list. And go to my website, mkaku.org, and it gives you the cities that I'll be speaking in, signing autographs of the book. Welcome. Once again, this is Dr. Michio Kaku, Professor of Theoretical Physics at the City College and the Graduate Center of the City University of New York, and this is the second half of Exploration. In the first half of Exploration, we began a discussion with Eli Kintish. He's a reporter for Science Magazine and the author of an interesting book called Hack the Planet, Science's Best Hope or Worst Nightmare for Averting Climate Catastrophe.
You know, some people, when they hear about global warming, simply roll their eyes up and says, oh, what's the use? It's too late. We've gone past the point of no return. We're doomed. Doom and gloom is all we get. Other people say, well, let's be proactive. Let's do something about it. Maybe we haven't hit the point of no return. We can change our lifestyle. We can lobby Congress. We can do things about it. We can save the planet. And then you have a third response. And the third response is, well, maybe we can engineer our way out of the crisis. Maybe science has helped to create the problem, but maybe science can also give us a solution to the problem. Well, the problem is pretty severe, and the Earth is huge, and our engineering abilities are rather primitive. So some of these schemes may sound a bit outlandish. Other people say, well, hey, what else are we going to do? Just sit back, roll over, and die? So let's take it seriously. Hack the Planet. That's the book. And we're going to continue our interview now with Eli Kintish of Science Magazine. Okay, so these are the doom and gloom scenarios. And again, they're worst-case scenarios. However, now let's talk about geoengineering, which on the surface sounds like a contradiction in terms. But let's talk about the first thing that comes to mind. If carbon dioxide is a problem, well, on the Earth, carbon dioxide is regulated by life. Life loves carbon dioxide and converts it into oxygen, plant life in particular, algae, for example. So what about using life to combat global warming?
The planet, as I said, you know, humans emit some 8 billion tons of carbon a year by burning fossil fuels and other types of emissions, like cutting down the rainforest. But many more than 8 billion tons of carbon are taken up every year by the planet's own carbon sinks, forests and marine life, like you said, like algae and microorganisms. And so there are ways to imagine enhancing the planet's own carbon sink by growing giant algae blooms, for example, to take in some of the excess carbon dioxide we've put into the atmosphere. And there's estimates that if we were to do, if we were to grow algae blooms on a massive scale, say around Antarctica, where there are plenty of nutrients but little life, you might be able to take up as much as 1 billion tons of carbon out of the atmosphere each year. The problem is, of course, that we don't know what some of the side effects of intentionally growing algae blooms would be. We can do it fairly easily because in some places, there's, like I said, there's plenty of nutrients in the water, but a certain trace nutrient, iron, is missing. And so a number of experiments have shown that when you sprinkle a dilute solution of iron into the ocean, you can grow algae on a mass scale. But scientists don't know what the effects of doing this year after year over large areas of the ocean might be.
Is there a possibility of a runaway effect there? For example, so-called Africanized killer bees were introduced into Latin America as an experiment, and they have since more or less taken over all the bee populations of Latin America. They're now entering into Texas and California, and so this was an experiment gone amok. You cannot recall a life form. So what about the problem of a runaway effect with these algae experiments?
There's a number of disturbing side effects that these algae experiments might cause. They might create large areas of the ocean devoid of oxygen, so-called dead zones. You might grow algae that's toxic. And a paper recently suggested that some of the algae grown in these early experiments on this idea had high levels of toxic proteins. You might create a situation where, as you create this algae bloom, the ecosystem that you create sort of below this algae bloom includes microorganisms that emit greenhouse gases. So you'd be taking in carbon, which is a substantial but a kind of standard greenhouse gas, and actually emit a greenhouse gas that's more potent and has an even greater warming effect. So you have to be careful what you grow, and there's a lot more science that needs to be done before anyone could consider doing this on a large scale. As for runaway effects, my book is full of examples of previous efforts by scientists to try to alter environments on large scale, and a lot of them go wrong, precisely because scientists don't always know what effects their interventions might have.
And also, Professor Freeman Dyson at the Institute for Advanced Study at Princeton has earned the ire of some people by saying that global warming has been exaggerated, but he does say that the Earth is warming, and that one way to counteract that problem is with genetic engineering, specifically genetically engineered trees that are specifically designed to maximally take carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere. What are your thoughts?
Well, there's a number of ways to, again, enhance the planet's important sort of carbon sink function right now, and that could be by growing different kinds of plants, by enhancing the plants we have now. I mean, one idea is actually to grow certain prairie grasses, which take up an amazing amount of carbon in their roots below the surface, much better than most weeds, which have very little carbon below the surface because they want to grow fast instead of for the long haul. And so, yes, there are various ideas about genetically modifying plants to take up carbon. There are also ideas to make plants shinier, because if you can make the planet more reflective in some of these more far-out schemes, you would reflect solar radiation away from the planet. So if you can make leaves shinier, some scientists have thought of actually making forests more reflective, because one of the risks with growing forests to take in carbon dioxide, Professor, is that you actually take a light-colored surface, maybe, ground, and put something dark on it. So you may be taking carbon, but you're actually making it more absorbing of solar radiation.
And some people have advocated pollution, deliberately creating pollution, like what happened with Mount Pinatubo, the volcano which erupted and caused the Earth to cool, because then volcanic ash reflects sunlight back into outer space. And the recent Icelandic eruption is expected to reduce in a tiny way the temperature of the Earth. So what about deliberately polluting the atmosphere?
Well, the Pinatubo example is a great one. In 1991, this volcano, which is in the Philippines, spewed some 10 billion tons of sulfur into the atmosphere. And those tons, sulfur pollution made it was forced out at such a massive pressure that it got up into the stratosphere, the high atmosphere above the weather. And there it stayed for about a year, and the planet's temperature went down about 1 degree Fahrenheit. You can see it on temperature measurements. The Icelandic volcano was much weaker and released about 6,000 times less pollution. And so it's unlikely that, like you said, would have much of a discernible effect. The idea with what I call the Pinatubo option in my book is that you would mimic this cooling effect that volcanoes have naturally, and you would do that by releasing the same kind of things, these sulfate particles, into the stratosphere, or maybe another particle which you find has fewer side effects. One of the problems with putting sulfate particles into the stratosphere is that you can destroy ozone, and ozone is a key is a key part of the atmosphere because it protects us from ultraviolet radiation. And the more stuff that's up there, we've found, the more natural processes come into play to destroy the ozone.
Well, one of the scientists who actually was in on the research on the ozone problem and won the Nobel Prize for it has advocated that we create a doomsday machine. A doomsday machine would only be used as we approach doomsday, with the worst effects of global warming. And the doomsday machine would have rockets, large numbers of rockets, which would deliberately go into the stratosphere and dump these pollutants into the atmosphere to create an artificial Mount Pinatubo. What are your thoughts about this, a doomsday machine?
Well, you don't really even need rockets. I mean, rockets might get, particles up into the stratosphere quickly, but all you really need is a balloon and a garden hose, to be honest. You might need a number of them because you have to spread the particles around properly. But, you know, one of the fears about the Pinatubo option, as I call it, is that it's relatively cheap. And, you know, this has become something of almost a proliferation risk, because say it costs $1 billion or $2 billion a year to maintain this sort of regimen of sulfate injections up into the stratosphere. Maybe a billionaire decides that he's tired of all the dithering on carbon dioxide, and he wants to cool the planet directly. And so he might deploy his own Pinatubo option. Maybe it's unlikely, but maybe a small state, you know, facing the worst effects of global warming would decide in the future. And so scientists are starting to think of geoengineering as a new global security risk.
Okay, now to change the subject slightly, you don't really mention it in your book, but there's the option of coal sequestration. That is, coal-fired plants produce copious quantities of carbon dioxide. So even if you have a hybrid, the hybrid in turn gets its electricity from a coal plant, which creates tremendous amounts of carbon dioxide. So some people have said, well, why don't we deep six the carbon dioxide, store it underground? And there's an experiment going on right now to see if it's economical to extract the carbon dioxide from a coal plant and inject it underground. Any thoughts?
There are a number of experiments around the world using the carbon dioxide created from natural gas or oil exploration. And now, as you said, there's one in Ohio looking at, you know, large-scale carbon sequestration from coal plants. The climate conundrum really starts and ends with coal. We're not going to be able to maintain the lifestyle we have in this country right now without coal, and certainly developing countries look to coal as the fastest way for them to get energy, specifically India and China. And so we have to find a way to make coal a more carbon-friendly fuel source. And what's needed, as you said, are these massive efforts to take the carbon dioxide that otherwise would have been put into the sky and put it essentially back where the carbon came from, in the ground. And this would be a massive endeavor. And right now, the cost estimates are somewhere between $50 and $80 per ton of carbon dioxide, which would increase everyone's fuel bills, electricity bills. And as you say, you know, even if you drive a hybrid car, that electricity for the car has to come from somewhere. And so while carbon sequestration for coal plants is probably not a geoengineering idea, it's going to be a big part of our energy system if we're going to be able to live sustainably in terms of our climate.
And what about the possibility of an accident? And all of a sudden, all this carbon dioxide suddenly is injected into the atmosphere after being stored underground. Any thoughts about that?
That they inject carbon dioxide as a matter of course all throughout Texas and in other places where you're trying to get oil out of wells. That hasn't happened, although there have been a couple of notable natural releases of carbon dioxide. But the geologists are looking closely at that risk, Professor, and you know, they are concerned about it. So far, most of the geologists that I interview have told me that it's not really a major risk. But I would say that if there was to be an accident like that, even if it didn't kill anybody, that would be a big, big setback for this effort to make coal more sustainable from a climate perspective.
Now, also, let's get a little bit into some of the harebrained schemes. In the past, the CIA looked into the possibility of geoengineering during the Vietnam War. That is, using silver iodide or seeding the clouds with crystals that would then form nuclei for water vapor and would help to induce the monsoon season in order to drown out any guerrilla offensive in Vietnam. Well, that was a catastrophic failure. Modifying the weather has always been something that armies, dictators, and statesmen have looked at, but nothing's ever come of it, or has it? What about the possibility of weather modification?
Well, actually, this is a billion-dollar industry around the world. I mean, the Chinese are facing a massive drought in their southeast areas, and they've actually, in the last few months, deployed one of the biggest weather modification, campaigns ever done. But really, I mean, hundreds of companies around the U.S. in hundreds of places do weather modification every year. Scientists are not sure it works. In some places, it probably does work. In other places, it probably doesn't. It's hard to know whether the rain you get one day may mean no rain next week, and if the rain you get in one place may not be that the guys next door aren't getting. And so weather modification is something that is happening despite the fact that scientists can't prove that it works.
So we don't know whether or not we're monkeying with Mother Nature correctly, or it could boomerang against us, right, at some point.
There have been a couple of court cases where weather modification experiments were followed by floods, and people died, and it's hard to connect one thing to the other. I don't think anyone's ever been found guilty in court of negligence for such an experiment. But in some places in the West, they really welcome weather modification because they want any rain they can get. But it's really difficult to connect the effects of an experiment with the actual consequences we see in nature. In fact, if we were to do this Pinatubo option, putting particles up into the stratosphere, Professor, it may be unclear what the effects would be, because to do it on a large enough scale so that you could tease out the signal from the noise, so to speak, you might be doing essentially global geoengineering. And so the line between experiment and actual deployment becomes fuzzy.
And I guess there's always the unintended side effects. For example, in China, they have a gigantic dam that is near an earthquake fault, and water will, in fact, grease the tectonic plates and induce earthquakes. And so there's concern that a recent earthquake was, in fact, artificially induced by water being injected into the tectonic plates because of the building of a dam. Well, you've looked at a lot of proposals. What are some of the more harebrained schemes being touted out there that maybe have no chance of ever seeing reality?
Well, some of the favorites are ideas which the Soviets came up with in the 50s and 60s. Now, we're thinking about geoengineering now because we're worried about the side effects of this global warming. But in the 50s and 60s, the Soviets were thinking about improving a cold climate, as they thought of it. And so they thought of putting giant Saturn rings into orbit above the Earth that would somehow reflect light onto the planet, or diverting water from the northern Atlantic, which is warmer water, into the Arctic Ocean to melt Siberia or the Arctic. And then there are ideas more modern of actually putting spacecraft between the Earth and the Sun to divert, say, maybe 2% of solar radiation away from the planet. And that would cool the planet off, obviously, directly. Also, concepts of brightening sea clouds, because that mimics a natural phenomenon that particles brighten the clouds above the ocean, as well as recently a scientist suggested making man-made whitewater. And so when you see whitewater at the shore or in a river, that's tiny bubbles, and that's actually more reflective than dark water, which doesn't have the bubbles in it. And so the idea would be to create massive swaths of these tiny bubbles in places where you want to cool the ocean or the planet.
Mm-hmm. And there's also the option of using space satellites, as you mentioned, to generate electricity. The Japanese are looking into it, and PG&E in California, believe it or not, is actually looking into it seriously, using space satellites to beam energy back down to the planet Earth. Well, you've looked at all these options. What do you think is really going to happen? I mean, you live on this planet. You have friends and family here. You're going to be affected, not just as a journalist, but as a human being. What do you think is going to happen, and what do you think is the best option that you've looked at among all these options?
I think what's going to happen in the future is if we are unlucky and the planet is on the more sensitive side to all the greenhouse gases we're putting into the atmosphere, I think that there could be some pretty desperate moves by countries or even, like I said, individuals to try to cool the planet, to avoid some of the worst-case effects. And we don't know what sort of effects those desperate moves could take or what they might be. They could be to try to cool the planet. They could be to try to take carbon out of the atmosphere on a massive scale. We don't know. But I think it's important for scientists and governments to start to think about these worst case, these geoengineering techniques, because we need to find a way to talk about them and regulate both their experiments on them as well as, you know, actually using them. I mean, I think the most important thing to do is to stop putting greenhouse gases into the atmosphere. Unfortunately, though, it's unclear that even if we halted emissions tomorrow, the planet's temperature would continue to rise because of the thermal inertia of the ocean, as well as the fact that carbon dioxide stays in the atmosphere for hundreds and thousands of years. And what? So we may, I think it's actually crucial that we study these very disturbing methods of cooling the planet, because in the future, the way to eliminate, to reduce suffering may be to try them.
Well, your book is called Hack the Planet, Science's Best Hope or Worst Nightmare for Averting Climate Catastrophe. Well, you still didn't answer the question. Is it going to be science's best hope or will it be the worst nightmare? That is, if you're going to put money on the table after looking at all these different options, which one do you think has the best chance of succeeding, or perhaps we should try another approach entirely?
I guess for me, we just don't have enough information. I don't mean to be elusive, but we've done almost no scientific studies of any of these options. A handful of modeling studies on the Pinatubo option, a few small-scale ocean experiments for growing the algae. We know there are natural analogs to many of these attempts, but we just haven't tried them in the same way that we've tried, you know, other engineering options that would help us live more sustainably, like, for example, the sequestering of carbon for coal plants. I mean, the main thing I think we need to do is to do science on this stuff while cutting our emissions aggressively. And that's because you're asking me as a journalist to put money on the table to bet on these options. Well, in 30 or 40 years, we may have to bet a lot more than one reporter's money. We may have to try something because we face a crisis, and we don't have enough information to make an informed decision yet.
And what do you say, though, to those people who believe that perhaps none of these options are going to work because the planet is huge and previous attempts have always failed, that the real emphasis is conservation, is going solar, is going to the electric car, the hybrid, looking at renewable technologies, the long, hard process of creating alternative fuels and conservation. So what do you say to those people?
Well, first of all, that is the most important thing right now. It is to change the way we use and produce energy is the most important thing, more important than studying geoengineering techniques. But you said, you know, that efforts to alter the planet have always failed, and I'm not so sure that's the case. I mean, there are certainly many examples of humans screwing up this planet. I mean, even just trying to encourage people in this country to grow biofuels by growing corn has led to, you know, food shortages in Mexico, and that's a pretty simple example. And so obviously it's far-fetched to think if we can't grow biofuels sustainably that we're going to be able to hack the clouds or alter the ocean in a wise way. That said, you know, we may cut our emissions tomorrow. I mean, you and I probably would agree that that's unlikely, but even if we were to cut emissions, we still may face a situation of mass suffering just because we're so far down this road already. And because of that, I think we have no choice but to think about these radical notions and try to figure out if any of them are realistic.
Okay, final question. Do you have anything to say to those listeners who may want to pick up a copy of your book, now hitting the bookstands, Hack the Planet, science's best hope or worst nightmare for averting climate catastrophe?
Yeah, the book's gotten great reviews, and I think the reason is that it's both informative and a fun read, full of wild characters and wacky ideas and real story of where we are as a species on this planet.
Well, we've run out of time, and once again, our special guest has been Eli Kintish. The book is called Hack the Planet. Well, in the remaining time on exploration, let me make an editorial comment, and that is, in my personal opinion, I say, why not? Why not look at these different alternatives, all the way from the reasonable and scientifically sound, all the way to the outlandish and perhaps even impossible? We should look at all different options, but we should not put our egg in the geoengineering basket. These options are very risky, very expensive, and we simply don't know if they're going to work. The main energy should go to energize ourselves to change our lifestyle, change our politicians, change our political and energy strategy so that we go in the direction of conservation, in the direction of renewable technology, in the direction of solar power, wind power, and all the different energy options. Now, personally, I believe that the cost of solar hydrogen keeps dropping every year, while the cost of fossil fuels, on average, rises every year, and the two curves will eventually cross. We don't know when, perhaps 10 years or so. And when the two curves cross, then market forces enter the picture, and then it becomes economical for even the heavy hitters in the energy industry to go solar, to go hydrogen, and that could initiate a sea change without having to geoengineer the planet. Well, I'm afraid that's it for Exploration. Once again, our special guest was Eli Kintish. He's a journalist with Science Magazine, and he's the author of a new book called Hack the Planet, Science's Best Hope or Worst Nightmare for Averting Climate Catastrophe. And if you want a copy of today's program, call the Pacifica Program Service at 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230 for a copy of today's program. And be sure to dial into my website. It's www.mkaku.org, mkaku.org. Good day.